This is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, the U.S. misses important post-9/11 security deadlines, and a federal study says the number of unwed mothers has hit a record high. Joining us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C., Yvonne Bino, author of the book Stand and Deliver, Political Activism, Leadership, and the Hip-Hop Culture. From our New York bureau, Pedro Noguera, professor of education at NYU, and George Curry joins us. He's the editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service. He joins us from Maryland. And for those of you that don't know or are familiar with the area, NYU, of course, is New York University. All right, folks, I said during the tease into this segment that the Democrats seemingly have found some life. We saw a very interesting session, a closed-door session, an unusual session that went on in the Senate yesterday, forced by the Democrats to face the question of looking at the intelligence used by the Bush administration that ran up to the war in Iraq and accusing Republicans of ignoring the issue. Democratic leader Harry Reid has been very strong over the course of the last couple of weeks, quite frankly, raising his visibility. George Curry, are we finally seeing signs of life from the Democratic Party on a national level to get in the ring and fight Republicans?
Well, we see a pulse there, and I was wondering about that before. But the question is, how long will it last? I mean, the Republicans were adamant about this. They are upset. In fact, the majority leaders, Frist, say he can't trust Henry Reid, the minority leader, anymore, and won't be able to trust him for the next year and a half. And this really is setting the stage for a real confrontation over the Supreme Court a confirmation hearing. But they certainly showed some signs. This hadn't been done in 25 years. And basically, they've been basically rolling over and playing dead up to now.
Yvonne, what of the common man who takes a look at Washington, D.C.? I was in Washington last week and talked to a number of people on the Hill and old school political heads who suggest that they've not seen this kind of partisanship and partisan bickering in Washington for a long, long time. Many are even suggesting they've never seen it this bad.
Well, I think that is what a lot of people are saying. In the past, certainly people could have come from different sides of the aisle and during the day had those debates and arguments. But later on, they did socialize. They did have relationships that also allowed them to make the compromises that were necessary within the political realm. Right now, we have two warring factions. And unfortunately, whether or not the Democrats have a pulse is almost irrelevant because they don't have the votes. So if we continue on this path, we're going to get no business done, or rather even less business than we're normally accustomed to. I also think that it is interesting that the Republicans always seem to raise the issue of civility when they are on the defensive. They seem to not particularly have that same stance when they are the ones who are pushing their policies or pushing agendas that the other side of the aisle is not in agreement with. So I think that was very interesting.
Pedro Noguera, what of the comments that we heard from many Republicans, operatives as well as senators, who suggested that this is nothing but a political stunt, if you will, I believe was the word used by some, that Democrats are just trying to gain attention but have no real want to figure out what, in fact, was the intelligence used and utilized by the president?
Well, that might very well be the case. It looks like political theater from the outside. But the main point is the issue that's being raised about the intelligence, the way intelligence was used to take the country to war, about the leaks of the names of the CIA operatives by the administration. I think it's important for the Democrats not to let that issue go away. And it's clear that Bush is trying to change the conversation with the appointment of the new, or at least his nominee for the Supreme Court. But we can't allow the violations that have occurred in national security that have been obviously perpetrated by the vice president, at least him, if not Karl Rove as well, to just go under, be swept under the rug.
George Curry, there are a lot of Democrats who are going to suggest, George, that this intelligence was the same intelligence that they utilized. More of them than not voted for this war initially.
They did, but the point was that they need to go back and review what went wrong and how it was all messed up, and that was the whole point here. And it's been almost a year, and Republicans basically do not like bad news, and so they've been sitting on this. And so the Democrats forced their hand. Well, my earlier point, Yvonne,
well,
was
nobody
that,
likes bad news politically on either side.
Yeah, I know, but they go to a great extreme to suppress it. My early point with Yvonne was, they need to have a pulse, but they need to have an alternative. And they've showed no signs of it. And even here, I don't know how long this will last. I'd be surprised if it does, because they have not shown, Democrats have not shown much backbone.
You're exactly right. And I also think that what is important is that we've had all this information from the very beginning. Anybody who's been following this news has seen the Republican or the Bush spin, however you want to term it. But whether we talk about the links to Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda or the lack of links, we can talk about Valerie Plame and all of that. But that information has been out there. So the Democrats have not been particularly effective in keeping on point and keeping this in front of the public eye and keeping some heat on these issues. So we're acting like this, the indictment of Scooter Libby is like some big deal, but the information has been there.
All right, Pedro Noguera, here's a $64,000 question. With all of what Democrats are doing, and we talked to Juan Williams and Ron Walters at the beginning of the week, and this is something that is being talked about, obviously, in Washington, particularly by those of a Democratic slant, and that is whether we're going to see the, quote, nuclear option, that's the language that the media likes to use today, to halt this Supreme Court nominee. Mr. Alito is someone that those on the far left clearly see as detrimental to the court. Should Democrats, as they gear up to make this noise, get ready to dig their heels in and make this the fight they want to put front and center?
I think this is an important fight. The question is, strategically, what's the best way to approach it? If you look at the front page of the Times today, you'll see that the Bush administration is actively courting the moderate Democrats. The Democratic Party's got to do the same thing with the moderate Republicans. They're going to have to make the case that this nominee is so extreme and so outside the mainstream that even the moderate Republicans, like the two senators in Maine and several others, cannot support him. If they can do that, they have a chance of not only blocking the nominee and therefore not having to use the filibuster, but also swaying public opinion. But I think to do that, they really have to expose why this particular nominee is unacceptable to the mainstream.
And I think the problem they're going to have with this is they confirmed the man before, I think, by 100% vote. And so you can't say, oh, he was all right then, and suddenly with the, now he has experience, he's going to be terrible. Sure, he has a record now, and people are certainly attacking that, but you can't say he's so inept and so unqualified when you voted for him before.
All right. I would agree with that. I mean, but the sad part about this, they put up Harriet Myers, and she was not qualified. She had no constitutional background. And now we have this guy. And I think, frankly, as a surety, he is going to be confirmed. As was said, he has already been confirmed. And I'm not sure that we're going to find that he's so radical. I think that certainly the Democrats may not agree with his views, but I don't think he's going to be such a nightmare that it's going to be unacceptable to the center of both political parties.
Well, it's interesting to me how we hear now about Harriet Myers being unqualified, and I'm not going to argue whether or not she was qualified or not, but certainly we've had others sit on the bench that did not have what we're calling this constitutional background before. It would not have been unheard of, and we did not, interestingly enough, even get an opportunity to hear for ourselves what this woman may or may not know by means of constitutional law and history, etc.
But unfortunately, she didn't demonstrate that she had any great acumen one way or the other. She seemed like she, from what I understood and what I read, she was a great litigator, a corporate litigator. She had done some other work, but there was no record, and Bush was not going to release what she had done in the White House.
No,
so that's what we were left with.
The
scant writings and her lack of constitutional background. And
one
that
can
on his
argue,
face,
though,
yeah.
This has become so political that we didn't even get an opportunity for ourselves to hear from her during the confirmation hearings, and therefore one would believe if it was to play itself out, had she proved herself, and I want to be careful with the words, but not suited for the job during the confirmation hearings, then that is why they are in place. The senators and others would have been able to turn her away. All right, let's turn our attention to
the difference, though, is that the Republicans have been saying we got to have up or down vote on these candidates. That's been their mantra. And then when it comes to Myers, it said, well, you know, I'm not feeling it. And so they don't want the same things, only when it's convenient.
Well, yeah, as I said, both sides of the aisles on that one, George. All right. We're going to take our attention to a number that the feds have released. 1.5 million babies born to unwed mothers in 2004. And the interesting twist to this, often we talk about teenage pregnancies. In 1970, half of the unwed births were to teen mothers. But in 2004, only 24% of unwed mothers were in their teens. The highest number, 55%, falls to the 20-something births given to those between the ages of 20 and 24. I should note, I'm sorry, and then the following, 28% would be 25 to 29. Pedro, when you hear this number and all of what we've heard about unwed mothers giving birth and the like, all of the monies that have been spent over the last couple of decades to try to curb this number, when you see the number actually escalating, what is it saying to us?
It says that the American family is in complete transformation, that increasingly large numbers of children are not born or raised in families with two parents. Less than 50% of households have a mother and father at home because we have a very high divorce rate. And so I think while it is troubling and certainly something that we need to pay attention to, I think the larger issue is why are so many Americans choosing not to marry, or when they do marry, choosing not to stay together? And then, therefore, what are the implications for children? And that's the question we're not asking enough. How do we, as a society, support children who are increasingly don't have the benefits of two parents at home?
And we should note here, George Curry, the idea that when we talk about unwed mothers, what this statistic does not say is that often the father is not around at all, let alone that the parents aren't married. He is not in that child's life, period.
Well, you have also a lot of couples cohabitating, and that's, you know, that has gone up tremendously. And some of the people suggest that because of the celebrities who are unwed and they get the glamour and people kind of take their cues from them. I'm not so sure if that's true or not. But I think this is striking when you look at a teenager. I mean, the good news in this is that dropped by almost half in terms of percentage of the teenagers. And so what's going on? What's been affected? That's the kind of key, because when you got basically 80%, 20% above, that's kind of different categories altogether. And so in some ways, I guess teens have been taking a bad rap here when really you're talking about people 20 and above.
But also, too, we're having two separate conversations. We have the mythology of the nuclear family, the mom, dad, two kids and the dog, and we have the reality that was stated earlier, that we have a 50% divorce rate. A lot of kids who are growing up from those households are not interested in marriage. They didn't see it work in their house, and they can't really understand the value of it. So we have a society that's still structured around the idea that you have a wife at home taking care of the children. As policy issues, we don't have child care, we don't have a sufficient parental leave. We have a whole lot of things that we need to decide as a country. Are we going to support marriage and the two-family structure as it really is and provide those supports, or are we not going to do that and just and stop wringing our hands about it? But the fact is, we are in transition. That whole Harriet and Ozzy fantasy has not existed for decades, and we have to be honest about that. If we look at Scandinavian countries, they have a high cohabitation rate, unwed mothers, but it's not the same tragedy because a lot of the women are better educated. They're professionals. There are resources there, plus there are societal supports there. So there's not the whole same conversation about the detriment to the child that we're seeing here. So we really have to get on, reconcile these two visions, the reality versus the mythology that we like to keep promoting.
But Pedro, the interesting point is what you raised. I think a decade ago or so, there was the question of the idea of the split of the nuclear family. This number looks at the babies being born without the existence of the nuclear family up front.
That's right. And I think that's the question that we need to try to get at. Why is it that a greater and greater number of women are choosing to have children on their own? And why aren't the men involved in the picture with raising kids? And, you know, I don't think this is something you can legislate. You can't legislate whether or not people can get married. But as Yvonne pointed out, you can, as a nation, address the consequences of these kinds of decisions. And they do have implications for child care, for after-school care, and child welfare generally.
But also, too, as a woman, though, the honest fact is there, if we're looking at certain criteria, a lot of men don't meet the criteria anymore. If you're looking for someone someone with a particular education level, a certain financial level. And in some communities, even if you take all that off the table, they're not marriageable men out there that people want to tie themselves down with. Yes, they want to have children.
But we're not suggesting, Yvonne, that these women are that calculating often.
Well,
I mean,
I don't know
like
that
they're saying, well... But we're not, I want to have a baby, but this guy isn't really.
We're not saying otherwise. We are okay with it. Certainly, there was a point in time when I don't know that was a great set of circumstances, but you were not encouraged to have children out of wedlock. That was not something that was socially acceptable. That taboo is off the table, frankly, right, for the vast majority of us. So to me, I meet somebody, if that's my inclination, we get together. If I have a child, I have a child and I move on. It's not, I don't have this same constraint that it might have been 40 years ago about the consequences of that particular action. And I think that certainly we cannot legislate that, but we have to understand that unless we can put marriage in a context that it makes sense emotionally and financially for people, they're not going to do it. They're going to continue to have kids, but they're not going to get involved in that long-term commitment scenario.
George, she raises an interesting point, but the stigma is gone.
The stigma is gone, but something else is happening. And we see this when all of us go around these college campuses and speak. Do you look at the college campuses across this country, and this goes directly to what you were saying, Yvonne, and you look in these classrooms and you see a disproportionate number of black women, and the first question is, where are the black men? So if you're talking about, quote, marriageable material, as you put it, it's going to get even worse based on what we see on college campuses.
And now it's even across the board that I think in the latest study there, across the board, there are slightly more women in general who are going to college than the men are.
All right. Let me stop it here because I've got to save it for the brothers. We're trying, y'all. We're trying. All right. Yvonne, Pedro, and George, thank you so much for being a part of the discussion as we talk about the ideal family. I believe you said Ozzie and Harriet. It's Florida and James. But, all right, guys. Thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it.